I think that any journalist who interviews Governor DeSantis should simply ask him right away, can you please define what woke is? I think that, you know, this has become a rallying cry. It's a branding tactic. And I just really want to understand exactly what he's fighting against, what he's fighting for. And then we could have a conversation going from there.
That's author Thomas Chatterton Williams, who takes issue with the excesses of both the right and the left in America's current cultural debates. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast. Thomas Chatterton Williams is the son of a white woman and a black man. He grew up identifying as black, but the birth of his daughter in 2013 changed his perspective on race.
My daughter was colored in a way where most people who would encounter her would not suspect that she was mixed. She forced me to confront the fiction of race in a way that I never had before in my own sense of self.
His latest book, Self-Portrait in Black and White, makes a case for unlearning race entirely. The provocative premise has drawn some harsh criticism, but Williams maintains that transcending race is the key to achieving equality.
I think that we should try to work towards a society where how you look and how I look tells you as little important information about me as an individual as possible.
Williams, who now lives in Paris and writes for The Atlantic, is also a prominent critic of cancel culture and so-called wokeness.
Now I think it actually is a term that cannot be redeemed. It cannot be dissociated from a lot of bad faith connotations or gaslighting on both sides.
And while he is hopeful for the future, he also has a warning.
The worst thing that could happen for trying to get past the excesses of the left is energizing the MAGA populist aspect of our politics and culture with Donald Trump's return to the White House.
Thomas Chatterton Williams, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You're a contributing writer at The Atlantic, a non-resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a visiting professor at Bard College. You have written two memoirs, the most recent titled Self-Portrait in Black and White, Unlearning Race. You're the son of a white mother and a black father from the South. And you grew up identifying as black. In fact, in 2012, you wrote that mixed race people have, quote, an ethical obligation to identify as black. But then the following year, something fundamentally changed in your life with the birth of your daughter. How did that moment alter your perception of race?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you have to do over the course of a life is revisit views you've grown up with and held closely and even thought of as core to your identity as I think facts and new information change or you become exposed to new perspectives. And so I grew up very much within this very American idea that a drop of black blood makes a person black because they're disqualified from being white. You know, this is a slave custom. This is logic from the plantation. But it also became a source of pride and solidarity within the black community that I was very proud to be a member of. And so even though I have grown up in a household with a white mother and a black father, I had a very straightforward sense of racial identity as a child and as a young man, which was simply that I was a black man of mixed race heritage, which was not such a strange thing in American history. Over the course of a decade of living in Europe, I began to just, you know, find myself explaining this logic to people that hadn't grown up in such a society, you know, society where slavery is within the national borders, has different ways of thinking about race than societies which might practice all types of colonialism and other things, but where that slavery is outside of the national boundaries. So the birth of my daughter was the first time that I had to put that idea that a drop of black blood makes a person black, and we must think of race as a binary either or, into real life practice in a way that I didn't with myself. My daughter was colored in a way where most people who would encounter her would not suspect that she was mixed. It wouldn't be self-evident. And so she forced me to confront the fiction of race in a way that I never had before in my own sense of self. And, you know, it wasn't that I thought, here I have a white daughter. It was that I thought, if I'm a black man who can have a daughter who looks like this, and she's a white-looking girl who can be almost a quarter West African descended, then what do these categories that we all adhere to even really mean?
The subtitle of your book is Unlearning Race. But you also recognize this complete rethinking of race is not something that can happen easily or quickly. In practical terms, What are you hoping to accomplish by telling your story?
That's a really well put question, because it's not as though I think that when you make these kinds of arguments, a lot of people think that you're saying, let's just not see race, let's pretend not to see race, and then all of our problems will disappear. And that's overly simplistic, and that's certainly not something that I would suggest. What I'm trying to say is that I think that we should try to work towards a society where how you look and how I look tells you as little important information about me as an individual as possible. I don't think that we can get to a society where we don't notice physical differences, human differences. Those will always be with us, but we can change the importance that we attribute to those physical differences and the conclusions we draw from those things. I want to interact with people and be surprised about where they come from without the myth or the veil of race coming between me and them.
How possible do you think that is? How practical do you think that aspiration is?
Well, I would never say that it's easy or it's going to happen overnight, but society changes in profound ways over time. And I've been really inspired by the degree to which we've been able to change the way we think about same-sex marriage, the way we've considered that gender can be a far more complicated discussion than we've previously had. I think that we can live in a multi-ethnic society where we say to each other, you know, what unites us is a common Americanness, and we all come from different places, and we really don't stand on firm footing when we think that we can make assumptions about other people based on how they appear. I think we can get to that.
So I don't need to tell you what the critics have said. There are, of course, you know, a lot of people have a lot to say about this theory and about your book. One review of the memoir in the Los Angeles Review of Books said, quote, you already know.
I know.
I read it for the audience sake. Quote, William's account of his life reveals a man who never had a natural, easy, or instinctive connection to Black people, just one in which, by his own admission, he imitated what he saw Black people doing on BET. So the reviewer suggests that as a result, abandoning racial identity was perhaps easier for you than it would be for others. Where are they wrong?
Well, they're wrong from the jump because, I mean, you're looking at somebody who, to a highly disproportionate degree, worships his Black father, who had a profoundly Black American experience, born in 1937 in the segregated South, a self-made autodidact who really modeled for me a kind of American integrity that is fundamentally influenced by the African American experience. And that is my hero. And that is in every sense of the word, that is the definition of my family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't have a large extended Black family. And some of the cultural tropes I identified with through BET, I came in later years to understand were really, you know, they were class associations that I was identifying with. I was trying to perform a kind of class behavior that seemed very seductive to me. And I'm not alone. I mean, the culture that I was caught up in is quite a popular culture. But the idea that, you know, dissociating from Blackness is something that comes easy to me because Black people don't mean anything to me is just something that, you know, I reject wholeheartedly.
Your father, as you mentioned, grew up in the segregated South. Your brother was even once beaten by police officers. But you write, quote, to my knowledge, in my adult life, I've never been harmed by my appearance or lineage. Is there something to the criticism that your prescription for unlearning race might not translate for a Black person who has experienced more severe and overt and consistent racism?
I think that we have to be honest about the fact that, you know, colorism is real, that Blackness is interesting in the American context specifically, but elsewhere too, in so far as people who are understood to be Black or racialized as Black within a lot of Western societies can have every kind of physical appearance imaginable. Yeah. You can have Black people who are essentially white looking and identify as Black, and you can have Black people who look as though very little mixing has gone on in their lineage. And so the idea that lighter, more Eurocentric appearing Black Americans have experiences that are not exactly the same as darker skinned Black Americans because of a kind of ambient skin racism There's something to that. I don't deny that. But, you know, I'm not alone in this idea that if we're going to achieve the kind of multi-ethnic society we purport to want to achieve, that we're going to have to go beyond the kind of, you know, doubling down on racial categories that come out of slavery. Some of the people that I most take inspiration from are some of the darkest skinned Black Americans making this argument, such as my friend Camille Foster, a really brave guy who is a dark skinned Black man who also is a so-called self-described race abolitionist. You don't have to have lighter skin to make the argument, though I wouldn't deny that it might be a little bit easier.
I don't have to tell you this. I mean, for Americans and Black Americans especially, you know, racial identity is inextricably linked to the history of subjugation, discrimination, and the struggle to overcome it. You don't think that abandoning race should mean letting America forget the sins of slavery and oppression?
No, not at all.
So square it for me.
Sure. I think that we can do two things at once. You know, we certainly have to know where we came from. But we actually cannot allow ourselves to be imprisoned by the sense that the bad things that have happened to us in the past to trap the present and to kidnap and hold hostage the future. There's this sense that has become quite popular in recent years that past discrimination necessitates present discrimination, which necessitates future discrimination. As far as I can see, you're caught up in a cycle that can never quite be made whole, because you're literally saying that you cannot be made whole without interventions that constantly produce new winners and losers. I think the past is really important. We have to take it seriously. But I'm interested in looking forward and imagining a kind of new future.
The author Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote, quote, "The plunder of Black life was drilled into this country in its infancy." And you are not alone in being critical of his analysis that too often, in the words of his critics, reduces Blackness to suffering. Is that the core fallacy in Coates' thinking?
I just want to say one thing about Ta-Nehisi Coates. You know, it's been a few years. His book came out in 2015, and around
that
time,
since then,
Between the World and Me, huge, huge cultural phenomenon. Around that time, I was associated with a critique of the book, which I believe was fair. But I want to say, as the years have gone by and the conversation has intensified, I really miss the kind of arguments and the care a writer like Coates was putting into the issues he was addressing. I don't think
How so?
Well, I think that he was first and foremost a writer and not an ideologue. And so I think he was making arguments that I can disagree with, but that were very worthwhile engaging, and that were coming from a place of good faith, and that he was doing it with a degree of talent and care.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, social media has, you know, further polarized us in the years since 2015, and lots of things have happened. You know, our politics became, you know, poisoned by the presence of Donald Trump. You know, we had the racial reckoning of 2020. And there's just a level of discourse that I don't think lives up to the standard that Coates was working at. And so I miss that argument that he was making. But I do think that it was problematic in certain ways, because it conflated the Black experience in its totality with a kind of oppression that happened to Black people throughout the course of history in this country, but which is really always, which has always been a bit more complicated than we can think from our present perspective, and which in the contemporary reality is far more complicated than a simple binary of victims and oppressors. And America, by the way, you know, I think it's always important to point out that, you know, Black people are foundational to the character of the country, but the America of 2023 is an extraordinarily multi-ethnic society, and there are many kinds of identities that are in between Black and white, and we have to have a much more complicated understanding of what oppression looks like in this day and age. And a lot of it has to be considered through the lens of class in a way that just talking about it through race doesn't grasp.
You said the conversation has shifted since 2015 when his book came out. What is the conversation you would have with him today?
Well, I would say first and foremost, you know, what I really appreciate about him is the fact that he said, "I'm a writer, and that means that I'm trying to ask questions. I might be wrong." I find that the conversation today is led by people that are not asking questions. They're giving you answers, and they're not taking any kind of contradiction. They're allowing no dissent. And that's a very, very different place to be having a very complicated and sensitive debate.
So it's a matter of posture.
It's also, I think, it's a matter of sensibility. It's a matter of character.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's something very different between somebody who is searching and somebody who has become a rigid ideologue. And on both sides of the debate, this is what is so difficult to be that detested term moderate or centrist. People on both sides of the debate are devouring you from both sides, and they're brooking no dissent.
The death of Tyree Nichols, after being beaten by Black Memphis police officers in January, has drawn new attention to police violence. And you've questioned whether Black Lives Matter's focus on race is the correct approach to solving the problem of police violence. And I wonder if an incident like this reinforces your reservations about confronting these issues through a racial lens.
Well, it did. I mean, I think most people are horrified by what they saw in this video. I mean, it was so bad, and I've seen enough that I couldn't watch the video, but I understand what happened. I have seen arguments be advanced that that itself was just a further instance of white supremacy, that you don't have to be white to be an agent of white supremacy. I think that that takes an issue that most people could rally around, which is that the police in America are extraordinarily brutal and violent, much more so than other wealthy nations that we're compared to in Western Europe and elsewhere. We tolerate a society in which too many American civilians can be killed by police, disproportionately Black, even more disproportionately Native American, numerically more white people than anybody else. Basically, everybody getting killed by police is poor. I think that we could have a serious conversation and a useful conversation that could bring us all together about how we don't want to live in a society where Americans of any ethnicity or background can be destroyed. You know, a couple of years, 3 or 4 years before George Floyd died the way he did, I mean, it's a deeply American irony that in almost the exact same fashion, Tony Timpa, a white man who suffered from schizophrenia and called the police because he wasn't on his medications, was knelt on and suffocated to death by police officers who were joking about it as they filmed it. That doesn't really grab us. That doesn't really make us say, you know, what's going on? That story only really even became known at all because of what happened to George Floyd. And we were rightfully outraged by what happened to George Floyd. But what happened to George Floyd is more complicated than simply Black and white, too. George Floyd was a very troubled and poor Black man. Mm-hmm. And we need to take that seriously, what it means that you can be destroyed by the state when you don't have an education, when you don't have economic resources. And so while I understand that there was a need to highlight the fact that Black people disproportionately suffer this response, I think we need to make the conversation go further than that. And that's really how we're going to solve some of these issues.
You've alluded now a couple times to a question of economic disparity as well, as another aspect of inequality that overlays with racial inequality. Do you see that as potent a lens for identifying disparities and then resolving them?
Well, I do. Yes, it's a fact that Black people are disproportionately economically disadvantaged. But the real problem is still the economic disadvantage. And when you do actually address that problem, you know, the idea that Black people are essentially poor is a kind of stereotype, but it's not. It doesn't get at the lived complexity of what the actual contemporary Black American experience is and has been for some time. The idea that white people are uniformly privileged also oversimplifies a much more complex American reality.
You volunteered for Barack Obama's 2008 campaign to canvass in some neighborhoods in Baltimore that were incredibly challenging neighborhoods for you to visit. Tell me how that experience shaped your thinking about race and economic mobility.
Yeah, I was young. I was in my, you know, that was the first political campaign I truly became excited about. That was the first time I ever felt moved to volunteer and canvass for a candidate. We're talking about 2008. I was a few years out of college. I went with two friends, one, a buddy of mine from Georgetown, Jewish American, one of my best friends, and one, a German friend who was working in New York on Wall Street and whose boss had been an early donor to Obama. He was actually, the German friend was the one who actually first even mentioned Barack Obama's name to me early in the days. When a lot of Black writers were actually arguing that Barack Obama wasn't really Black. I became really, really excited by the possibility of this man's campaign, the kind of healing that his presence did seem to be offering the country. And so, you know, we signed up to canvass in West Baltimore. And I grew up in New Jersey, not far from Newark, New Jersey. I had been living in Brooklyn. I had lived in Spanish Harlem. I'd attended school in Washington, D.C., and I had still never seen a level of American poverty like what I witnessed going around those neighborhoods in West Baltimore. It was astonishing to me as a lifelong American citizen. People were so cut off from concerns like choosing Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton. I'm talking about you're knocking on people's doors who had never heard of Hillary Clinton. And you're dealing with a level of need and a level of suffering that one of the lessons I came away with, and this was several years before I started to question racial categories the way I would later after the birth of my daughter, but I left wondering how the people answering their doors would think that the thing that unified me and them, the racial ancestry, was more significant than all of the other class and educational markers that united me with my Jewish friend and my German friend. I don't think that they saw me and said, hey, me and him are all in the same boat and the other people are out of the boat. And, you know, that was an eye-opening experience for me. That's the first time that I realized that I thought of myself as embodying a kind of monolithic Blackness. But I don't want to come across as naive. You know, I'm in my 20s, but I hadn't really thought profoundly about what it means to be in the Black middle class and what that had opened up access for me to escape.
Let's take it to contemporary politics now. Scott Adams, the creator of the comic strip Dilbert, sparked controversy recently after declaring that Black Americans are a hate group and urged white people to, quote, get the hell away from them. In response, the comic was dropped from hundreds of newspapers, and he's now relaunching it on a subscription site. Some critics of cancel culture have come to Adams' defense, and you have decidedly not. Why?
So this is a really interesting question. And, you know, I don't want to get too technical about it. But, you know, cancel culture is a term that I try not to use because I think that it can obscure more than it can clarify. Oftentimes, you know, people use it in a lot of different ways and people bring different interpretations to the term. I try to say exactly what's going on instead of using the catch-all term. And I think you need to be very, you know, very honest that, you know, we have established norms. And we have norms that are still contested and are contested in good faith that people are fighting to make become established. Advocating that an entire group of Americans is essentially a hate group and that you should segregate on the basis of race to avoid them, this is violating a long-established norm of decency. He's espousing a kind of racism that does not need to really be fought for. You don't have to really make the case that what he said is racist.
We fought that war.
We fought that war. And some wars have to be finished. And so I don't think that if you knowingly go out and initiate a conversation that knowingly engages in racist talking points, that then you can go and cry and say, I've been canceled, if people don't appreciate it and want to dissociate themselves from you. That's not the same thing as cancel culture. What people typically mean by cancel culture is violating a not yet established norm, sometimes a norm you don't even know exists yet, being called out oftentimes within the context of a social media mob, and then having your employer targeted so that they are compelled to have to fire you. And then your name is further stigmatized so that it's difficult to find work elsewhere. That is kind of the thing that happens. And the power of cancel culture is the onlooker effect. So people become scared to say those things. You don't have to have an onlooker effect to make people uncomfortable espousing the kind of racism that Scott Adams was. Sorry, that was long-winded.
No. I'm gonna put a finer point on it using your own words. In response to the controversy, you tweeted, quote, "This is not cancel culture. If you film yourself going on a stupid and boring racist monologue and upload it to the internet and people notice it and react negatively, you just have to play it as it lays."
I think that's fair. I mean, I would never be opposed to his freedom of speech. He has the right to express himself. But, you know, you put yourself into the arena And you can't expect that nobody will actually take issue with what you said when it's highly objectionable.
You're opposed to the teaching of the ideas of critical race theory and this whole philosophy of anti-racism in schools, but you've also made clear that you don't support Republican-led efforts to ban it. Let's start with your objections to critical race theory, CRT. You don't disagree with anti-racist scholars that there is a deeply ingrained racism in the country. So what's wrong then with that approach?
Well, I think that it can be more subtle, the degree to which racism permeates all aspects of our society. I think that things are more complicated than that. I do think that, you know, the legal field of critical race theory, you know, if you read Derrick Bell or some of the original scholars, they make some points that I think are not that crazy. They say that, you know, traditional ways the law can be applied can miss the granularity of racial difference when people are coming face to face with the criminal justice system, for example.
These could be taught in law school, though.
Absolutely. Now, the vulgarization of some of these concepts, and, you know, I think that this has to do with the way that certain esoteric and complicated academic jargon and frameworks get disseminated on social media widely, mm-hmm. and get misused and misapplied and also become vulgarized, popularized. You know, you get into a situation where, you know, I don't even like to use the word or the term CRT because activists on the right have also manipulated that term. Christopher Rufo has been very vocal about using that term to mean anything that a lot of normies could be opposed to. So that's a manipulation of language. But it is true that, you know, there is something really wrong going on in some of these schools, some of these elite private schools in New York City, where kids are being told to take privilege walks, to break into groups based on race. Chinese kids sit with the Chinese kids, Black kids with the Black kids, Jewish kids with the Jewish kids, as young as 8 years old at some of these schools. There's something wrong with it. To take the lens of race or gender or sexuality and make that the be-all, end-all, and to discriminate based on race, you know, these are things that we can oppose. However, I don't think that, you know, I don't think that you can respond to bad ideas with an authoritarian impulse to ban. That type of censoriousness should bother all people that are committed to an open society and the liberal exchange of ideas. What's going on in Florida, what's going on in a lot of these regions of the country where you're getting into situations where teachers are not sure if they can teach Letter from a Birmingham Jail because it might violate some new law. This should trouble us all.
Letter from a Birmingham Jail, Martin Luther King's most famous letter that he wrote when he was in jail in Birmingham, of course, during the Civil Rights
Act. That might violate some of the new anti-CRT legislation that's popping up daily around this country.
I mean, 18 states have passed anti-CRT laws. You just mentioned Christopher Rufo, for the sake of the audience. Christopher Rufo, a scholar at the Manhattan Institute, who has codified and really popularized a right-wing, or maybe galvanized right-wing support around being against critical race theory. Mm-hmm. A, how do you understand his argument, and then how do you critique it?
Well, I take his argument at face. When somebody tells you what their argument is in explicit terms, you can trust them. He tweeted, and, you know, this has been remarked on, you know, widely, but it hasn't damaged the kind of movement he's been building. But he tweeted that we are moving to make CRT, we're branding that term as associated with anything that makes normal folks uncomfortable, basically, that doesn't poll well. So that's explicitly what his argument is.
It's a political term.
He is a sophisticated debater, and he can get into some of the texture of the issues at hand. But he's pretty straightforwardly said that CRT is a anti-left branding tool to win votes and to take back power institutions in schools and other places. That's what he means by it. He doesn't mean that he's engaging seriously with the complicated mm-hmm. ideas mm-hmm. that Derrick Bell first publicized.
I like this quote. You've described anti-racism as a moral panic, similar to the satanic panic of the 1980s. What do you think it takes to break the mindset?
That's a good question. I think that we have to take a step back. When you say anti-racism, you know, a lot of well-meaning people would say, well, what's wrong with that? I'm certainly, you know, anti-racist in the sense that I think racism is terrible. I don't think that people should be put in groups based on so-called categories such as race and then slotted into a hierarchy of worth. But anti-racism as a movement, as it's been marketed and sold in the past few years, has really, it's gotten locked into a mindset that race is the primary lens through which every question can be considered through, and that all disparities between groups are based on a kind of fundamental oppression, and that must actually be addressed by positive discrimination. And this must, and our fundamental duty is to uncover racism and oppression everywhere it is, and to counteract it. I don't think that's how human reality actually works. I think that a lot of us are motivated by all types of ambiguous factors, and that we are not necessarily always operating on a binary of oppressor and oppressed. And so when I oppose anti-racism, I oppose this idea that there is always a moral question lurking behind every interaction, and that even, you know, even situations in which basic human error could be, or ignorance could be at play, are always nefariously linked to a kind of racist manipulation.
Another term that has perhaps become vulgarized, you might say, is this term woke. What do you understand about the origins of the concept of wokeness?
Well, you know, when in the early aughts, whenever Erykah Badu was singing about stay woke, you know, I thought that sounded cool. You know, the word, like a lot of Black slang, the word, it's great. I mean, I understand why it caught on so widely, because it just works so much better than awake. Or, you know, it just does something that makes vivid the idea that, like, be conscious, be aware. That's how it started out. I don't think, you know, anybody disputes that.
Be specifically aware of what?
You know, be aware of any type of, you know, don't be asleep when, you know, there's inequality in the society. It doesn't even have to be racialized inequality. Just be more aware. Don't sleepwalk through life and just, you know, do your part to contribute to a status quo that is less than it could be. Do your part, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. But then, you know, it became a term that critics of the kind of excesses that we were talking about in terms of the anti-racist kind of moral panic, and also like questions having to do with sexuality and gender and climate and class and other things, critics of the excesses of these movements, of these activist movements within institutions, slapped the term woke on to describe this cocktail of values and new evolving norms that are being kind of enforced throughout society by an activist left.
As a generic catch-all term.
As a generic catch-all term for some excesses that are very real and that should be critiqued. With that evolution of the term, those on the left obviously dissociated themselves from the term and disputed that it described what they are in fact doing. So there's a real dispute between people who say, well, you know, like just like anti-racism, wokeness is just being empathetic. It's just being aware of what's going on. But that's not what it means anymore. So what does it mean now? Now I think it actually is a term that cannot be redeemed. It cannot be dissociated from a lot of bad faith connotations or gaslighting on both sides. Yeah. And so what you actually have to reach for is specific language to describe the processes and problems that you're really trying to either promote or critique.
Has the wave of wokeness peaked and is it receding? Or, you know, there are others who say, you know, they cite developments of like the rewriting of Roald Dahl's latest books, mm-hmm. Like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. How do you see it?
So I think, you know, to channel the philosopher Hegel, you know, the owl of Minerva spreads its wings at the falling of the dusk. That's a long-winded way of saying that you can't really tell until like you're out of the thing when it's over. I would say it's premature to say that wokeness has peaked. It may have you know, there's always going to be a reaction to the perceived excesses of a previous generation. From what I understand, you know, Gen Z has a very different sensibility than millennials like myself have had. That's natural. But I think that, you know, when you talk about peaking, it's not as though a pendulum swings back and forth, or you peak and then you go back down to where you were before. I think it's more interesting to think of it as a ratchet that turns and then it stays where it was, or a frame that moves and you still stay within a frame. These ideas have become, some of these practices and ideas have become entrenched. We're not going back to 2012. Like, basically, most liberals like myself, ideas of the before times, the good times, you know, like that was where I thought society was pretty, you know, positive in a lot of ways. We're not going back to that. Some of these ideas have taken over institutional decision making in a way that you can't talk about in terms of peaking.
In the context of the political fight over wokeness, Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis is really at the forefront. He claims that his state is where woke will go to die. It's a direct quote. He's incredibly popular with Republicans right now, Governor DeSantis, and he could even stand a good chance of receiving the presidential nomination from the Republicans, if you believe the polls at the moment. Does it alarm you that this approach is a model for other Republicans to celebrate and emulate?
Yes, and I think that any journalist who interviews Governor DeSantis should simply ask him right away, can you please define what woke is? I think that, you know, this has become a rallying cry. It's a branding tactic. Christopher Rufo has been very closely working with Ron DeSantis. And I just really want to understand exactly what he means by what is going to die, what he's fighting against, what he's fighting for. And then we could have a conversation going from there. But right now, I think it's a very cynical, polarizing tactic. And I think that what this country needs is a lot less of that, whether you're on the left, right, center, or whatever.
You've described Donald Trump as, quote, the biggest instigator of wokeness. Trump remains the front runner for the Republican nomination in 2024. If both sides of this social justice debate are already at dangerous extremes, where will Trump's return to the spotlight and potential return to the White House leave us?
Well, then wokeness would not have peaked, because Donald Trump, all his presence makes possible a state of exception where people opposed to him basically say, well, we don't have the luxury of defending free speech now. We don't have the luxury of objectivity in journalism now. This is an emergency. Those values go out the window. And then they start embracing illiberal kinds of reactions to the very real problem of his political career. So I think that, you know, these two opposite ends feed off of each other. And the worst thing that could happen for trying to get past the excesses of the left is energizing the MAGA populist aspect of our politics and culture with Donald Trump's return to the White House.
Wait, what do you mean by journalists lose the ability to pursue objectivity?
Well, I mean, there's been an ongoing conversation since the Trump years that objectivity actually allows, you know, Donald Trump to pervert. People like Donald Trump can take advantage of objectivity because there really aren't two sides to an issue. That's a slippery slope to go down. Because, you know, once you get rid of objective standards, you won't always be the decision maker deciding what's too far, what is an emergency requiring a response that doesn't have time for legitimating the other side. The reason why you embrace standards such as objectivity is because you won't always be in control. So you want to have basic standards that are fair for everybody involved.
You mean, for example, the idea of what is true, what is a fact, what is a conspiracy theory versus something that is provable? The fact that he won the election or lost the election, the big lie. Is that what you mean by objectivity and truth? Or
no, I think objective truth interrogates those things. I don't think it means that flat earth gets the same hearing as, but I mean, I don't think that you can simply say that that anything, you know, I'll give you a good example. It was widely thought that we can't really consider a lab leak as a valid possibility when COVID-19 first came to the United States, because Donald Trump had become associated with that. And it was a kind of racism to even ask the question that now the Department of Energy and other institutions are saying they're leaning towards believing is what happened.
So you're saying we lose objectivity because we are so polarized about him as a figure.
Exactly.
I see. You've often cited the arguments of economist Glenn Lowry, and specifically his arguments against affirmative action. Lowry appeared on the original firing line with William F. Buckley Jr. in 1991, and he made the case that affirmative action cannot rectify historical injustices. Here he is in 1991 making that argument.
I think there's very little that a university can do to remedy profound social historic injustices. Indeed, I think it's a profound truth of our time that there's very little that can be done to remedy some injustices, and that one has to recognize that. That's not to say that one shouldn't be concerned about justice. It's to say that one should be have one's eyes fixed on what it is that one can best do. Now, I'm concerned, for example, about the consequences of historic injustice against blacks, so reducing the numbers of young people who have had the opportunity to get the education that would allow them to perform in our universities. And my answer to that is not to lower the standards of our universities, but it's rather to address myself to the impediments of family, community, primary education, et cetera, that make it so difficult for those young people to put themselves in a position where they can take advantage of these things.
The Supreme Court is considering a case that could end affirmative action, and their ruling is expected to come down by the end of this court's term, probably this summer, early this summer. You've argued affirmative action leads blacks to be held to lower standards and reinforces prejudices. Is eliminating race-based preferences a step towards the kind of society you talk about in your book?
It's a complicated question. It's also very difficult to follow.
Glenn Lowry.
He's really, I've told him many times that he speaks in full paragraphs. He's an amazing intellect, and I consider him a friend. And he's actually kind of probably most responsible for challenging, certain assumptions I came into the conversation around affirmative action with when I first started talking about that with him. I had never really thought very hard about doing away with it. I thought it was kind of a necessary aspect of our society that, I wouldn't want to have to rely on, but I felt like it wasn't the time to talk about doing away with it either. Glenn makes a point that I can't get out of my head, which is that you cannot have equality so long as you have separate standards for people in perpetuity. I think there was a time when you had to have separate standards to even the playing field to a degree. But if you make, and I don't know when that time will be over, but if you make the argument that it has to be permanent, then you're saying that actually these groups of people are not and will never be equal. That's not something that I would ever be able to embrace for myself.
The question really, it seems to me, and I posed this to Glenn, is when? When is the right time? And he's an economist, he's empirical, he's quantitative. How do you know when it is time? And he actually couldn't answer that. I mean, he's intuitively says, I just think it's now.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
I know
I get it, we're at the end of the road. But how do you know that? I mean, if you consider Jim Crow was in place for 100 years before the Civil Rights Act, maybe 50 years isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, Sandra Day O'Connor said, in the early 2000s that, you can imagine in 25 years not needing it anymore. Well, we're almost at the point she imagined now. And a lot of people would disagree that we've reached the point where we can do away with it. I think we have reached a new crisis point, though, because something that is happening that is impossible to ignore is that a lot of people who fall under the identity category Asian American are not actually getting a fair shake as individuals. And that's not something that anybody concerned with justice can simply say is unimportant. That's an issue we have to figure out how to deal with. And the kind of way that our affirmative action and our legacy admissions and all these other ways of getting into college are set up is that somebody has to, the buck stops with somebody, and it stops with Asian Americans all too often in ways that are fundamentally unfair.
Yeah. You're working on a new book. titled Nothing Was the Same, The Pandemic Summer of George Floyd and the Shift in Western Consciousness. It's nearly 3 years later. How has Western consciousness shifted since that summer?
That's the question that I am trying to figure out.
Give us a preview. You can come back to.
Well, I think, you know, it's going in the direction that some of your previous questions took. You know, has this peaked? This is really what I'm trying to understand. You know, something happened in 2020. I think there are certain hinge points in our history. You know, there are summers, there are moments, there are seasons after which you can say there was a before and an after. Summer of 2020 was one of those moments. We actually had new conversations, new norms, new hiring practices in our cultural institutions, our academic world, our media institutions, elite corporate spaces. There was a before that summer and an after that summer. You know, a lot of people who hoped for a kind of revolution, I think, are correct to point out that society didn't fundamentally change in ways they may have hoped. You know, at the time, it seemed like there was a serious move to defund and fundamentally alter policing. That seems to not have happened. That seems to have been rejected by some of the very non-white communities on whose behalf those arguments were being made, which is very interesting. I think one of the things that I've learned in taking the time to write this book is that any conversation about how the culture changed because of that summer, that confluence of the pandemic, the racial reckoning, and the specter of Trump haunting it all, those three factors combined to make the moment. But now we have to talk about the severe reactionary backlash that has been engendered by that moment too. And so the story has to be an understanding of how nothing was the same also because of this massive backlash.
Final question. Are you hopeful that America can get to a healthier place on race than we currently are?
Oh, I am. James Baldwin said, you know, I'm a Black American. I have no choice but to be an optimist. And I really take that seriously. I mean, I live in a different country than my father grew up in. The difference between generations is enormous. I have no doubt that we're going to continue progressing. I do not think the future of America is the kind of movement that Donald Trump brought forth. I think it really is that movement that got me excited and out in the streets of Baltimore trying to canvass door to door. I think we are moving towards that better multi-ethnic society that we glimpsed and then we took a detour from. Mm-hmm. But that's where we're going. I have no doubt about that.
You're sure it's that one direction, not some hybrid?
I think the route can be circuitous and it can be curvy and perilous, but I think that we are moving in that direction. I really do.
Thomas Chatterton Williams, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.